KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Everything is shaking. I don't know what to say. Speechless. It's a disaster.
Another night of deadly airstrikes in both Iran and Israel as the conflict between the two countries escalates. For Sunday, June 15th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. We'll have the latest on the conflict and how U.S. officials are viewing the fighting between Iran and Israel. And we'll remember the Minnesota lawmaker murdered in her home.
Melissa Hortman has gone down as the most consequential and impactful Speaker of the House in Minnesota history.
We'll also hear from a group trying to track immigration raids in Los Angeles.
We've had reports of even entire families with small children being held in office buildings where they're only given potato chips and milk for a three-year-old child.
Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In Minnesota, the manhunt for the suspect in the shooting deaths yesterday morning of a state lawmaker and her husband and the wounding of another state lawmaker and his wife, who remain hospitalized, continues. Drew Evans with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension says a nationwide warrant has been issued for Vance Belter and that his car has been found.
We did locate in that area that led us a vehicle that we had interest in related to him yesterday that we were searching for, and it was located in Sibley County very early today. Also, I know it's been reported a hat that we believe he was wearing was found in proximity to that vehicle.
And that's led police to tell people in that county southwest of Minneapolis, where Belter has a home, to be careful. Governor Tim Walz is calling it a politically motivated assassination. Police continue to search for a motive. President Trump is heading to the G7 in the Canadian province of Alberta. The annual meeting of advanced economies comes amid high international tensions with the Iran-Israel conflict and tariffs that Trump himself imposed. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
The White House has said Trump hopes to talk about a range of topics, including migration, critical minerals, and trade. Trump has imposed tariffs on goods from all fellow G7 members. It is likely that he will talk to other leaders about striking deals on tariffs. Several non-G7 leaders have been invited, including Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, meaning Trump could have one-on-one conversations with them. Trump's last Canadian G7 ended with him insulting then-Prime Minister Justin Trudeau over tariffs. This year's summit may also be tense between the U.S. and Canada, as Trump has repeatedly said he wants the country to be the 51st state. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
At least five people have died. Several more are still missing in West Virginia's northern panhandle, west of Pittsburgh, after a flash flood last night. Chris Schultz from West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrisey declared a state of emergency for Ohio County Sunday morning after the region received 3 inches of rain or more in just 30 minutes. Rushing floodwaters picked up vehicles and washed out roads, bridges, and highways, necessitating swift water rescues. Lou Vargo, Emergency Management Director for Wheeling and Ohio County, says the speed of the flood and the impact to local infrastructure has severely limited emergency response.
There was people in trees. We had a trailer on fire that the road on both sides of that was given out.
More heavy rains are forecasted in the area through Sunday evening, renewing concerns for further flooding. For NPR News, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown, West Virginia.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. You're listening to NPR News. In India, the death toll in the London-bound Air India Boeing Dreamliner plane crash into a medical college hostel minutes after takeoff last week is rising. Authorities say at least 270 people died in both the plane and on the ground. The lone surviving passenger is still hospitalized for observation. Search and recovery teams are still at the site of one of the country's worst aviation disasters for a third day. The cause of this crash still isn't known. Peacocks are treasured for their majestic displays, but in Tutbury, England, the townsfolk have had quite enough of an expanding population of the birds ravaging gardens and private property. Vicky Barker has more from London.
For the past quarter century, a relentlessly growing population of peacocks has prowled the village of Tutbury. Locals complained they screech day and night, and as one told a reporter, they could poo for England. Officials say the birds are the responsibility of whoever owns them. Local lore says they once lived at nearby Tutbury Castle until neglect forced them to scavenge for food in the village. Now, Tutbury Castle is part of the Duchy of Lancaster. One of King Charles's many titles is Duke of Lancaster. The Duchy's website says His Majesty, quote, takes a keen interest in the estate and his tenants. Apparently, not that keen. For NPR News, I'm Vicki Barker in London.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Israel and Iran exchanged fire for a third day today. The Iranian Health Ministry has put the casualty number there at more than 220, but activists say it still could be higher. The official Israeli Search and Rescue Service says 13 people have been killed in Iranian airstrikes since Friday. Here with the latest is NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv, where sirens have sounded. Welcome.
Thank you.
Where are you right now? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing okay, thanks. I'm currently speaking to you from a bomb shelter, and that's why I may sound a little bit echoey. This is the second attack of the day so far. Sirens just went off, followed by huge booms, which usually means Iranian missiles being intercepted by Israel's powerful air defense system called the Iron Dome. We just got a notice from the Israeli military, though, that a number of places were hit, but it's still too early to tell exactly where. I mean, overnight, we actually experienced some of the worst of the strikes coming from Iran. The sirens went off a few times around 3 a.m. local, and we were in the shelter for a fair bit of time. Explosions were fierce, and some missiles dodged the Iron Dome and hit a number of neighborhoods there yesterday too. This morning I visited the worst hit area called Bat Yam, south of Tel Aviv. Over there I saw search and rescue teams wearing orange vests. They were all around a massive high rise that was completely gutted from one side. Rubble, mangled metal from inside of buildings all over the place, shattered windows, glass on roads. The paramedics I talked to said they were still looking for three people trapped under the debris. Six people were killed there. I met 61-year-old Kopchak Ilana. She said that she was in her home's bomb shelter when the missile hit nearby.
Everything is shaking. I don't know what to say. Speechless. It's a disaster. I can't eat. I can't sleep.
Hadil, Israelis are not strangers to rocket fire and sirens and bomb shelters. But looking at some of the images of this destruction, this really, from here at least, feels different.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, Israelis are actually normally nonchalant about missile fire. They become that way. You know, they live near Gaza, where Hamas has fired rockets for years into Israel, Lebanon, where Hezbollah has fired rockets also. But this is different. This kind of destruction to residential infrastructure and military targets and people being killed is something many Israelis haven't seen before. And, you know, I did speak to an Israeli friend today over coffee, and he said, I feel like we got a taste, a small taste, of what Palestinians in Gaza have been experiencing from Israeli airstrikes on a daily basis and at any moment.
What do we know at this moment about what's happening in Iran?
Well, we know that Israel has been going for energy sources since last night. Iran's oil ministry said that a fuel and gasoline depot in North Tehran was hit. So was one of the country's largest oil refineries in Tehran's north. Also, two main Iranian energy sites offshore in the south of Iran were also targeted. And then the Israeli military said that it hit the Mashhad airport in eastern Iran. They said it was the deepest strike in the country that they've done. And you know, today, President Trump called on Israel and Iran to make a deal, and he said that, quote, many calls and meetings now taking place. But neither Iran nor Israel have said anything about those calls or meetings, and so for now, they're both committed to exchanging fire.
That is NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And for a look at how the conflict is playing out in the U.S., we are joined now by NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie here in Washington. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Scott.
So we just heard President Trump saying a lot of talking is going on. What more did the president have to say?
Yeah, the president went on Truth Social and said, quote, we can easily get a deal done between Iran and Israel and end this bloody conflict. Now, in the same posting, he said the U.S. has nothing to do with the Israeli attacks on Iran, and he warned he would unleash the full strength of the U.S. military if the U.S. is attacked. So, in short, Trump is and has been sending this somewhat mixed signal. He's supportive of Israel, and the U.S. military is helping defend Israel. But Trump doesn't want the U.S. to take part in offensive operations against Iran. He doesn't want the U.S. dragged into another Middle East war. So he's trying to take this middle ground, but the longer the fighting goes on, the harder it may be for Trump to maintain this position, backing Israel with the U.S. involved to a certain degree, but not wanting to be too involved.
Tell me more about that then, especially since the president is saying the U.S. has nothing to do with the offensive things Israel is doing. Tell me more about how the U.S. is helping defend Israel.
So U.S. warships were already in the eastern Mediterranean off the western coast of Israel when Israel launched the attack early Friday on Iran. Those ships and the planes on those ships have taken part in the effort to shoot down Iranian ballistic missiles targeting Israel. Now, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed this in an interview with Fox News today, and he thanked the U.S. for its support. You know, also the U.S. has provided Israel with air defense for many, many years, and last year provided a new cutting-edge system known as THAAD. We don't have all the details of the current fighting, but the U.S. military is clearly actively supporting Israel, just as it did last year when Israel and Iran had some missile exchanges.
Say this goes on, say this possibly escalates even more. Could the U.S. and Israel comfortably maintain this level of cooperation, or do you think there's a point where there's friction?
You know, there are going to be issues to be worked out. Netanyahu has talked for years about attacking and completely destroying Iran's nuclear facilities, and there's every indication he's prepared for a long operation. In contrast, Trump is saying publicly he wants the fighting to end quickly. And here's one specific example, Scott. Iran has a key uranium enrichment facility built deep inside a mountain in a place called Fordo, south of the capital, Tehran. Israel may not have enough firepower in its arsenal to penetrate the mountain and destroy the facility, but the U.S. does have more powerful bunker-busting bombs. If Israel can't destroy this site on its own, it'll be asking the U.S. for help if it hasn't already. And as we noted, Trump is reluctant to attack Iran directly.
Lastly, the Trump administration had been negotiating with Iran over the nuclear program. How has that effort collapsed at this point?
Well, it's certainly off the table for now. Virtually no chance it can be revived while the fighting is ongoing. The U.S. and Iran were supposed to have their sixth round of talks today in the Arab nation of Oman. The previous rounds have been described as serious, though no breakthroughs were reached. Trump has been making some very tough demands on Iran. He called on Iran to give up its nuclear program in its entirety. Iran has always rejected this, saying it has the right to use uranium for peaceful purposes, such as civilian power plants. So there were obstacles. They're even more difficult now.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Scott.
The political assassination yesterday of Minnesota lawmaker Melissa Hortman was a shock to the people in the state and around the country, and a manhunt is ongoing for her killer. This was another moment that led to broader questions about rising political violence in the United States. And in the meantime, a community is grieving. Clay Masters of Minnesota Public Radio has this remembrance of Melissa Hortman.
It took a couple of tries for Melissa Hortman to get elected to the Minnesota legislature. But in 2004, the attorney won a seat in the state house, defeating a Republican by 2 percentage points. She would go on to serve as minority leader before being elected speaker in 2019. NPR News asked her then what being a woman brings to the job. The question could kind of irritate her.
It's really about the job. And we don't ask that when a man like, hey, Kurt Dowd, are you going to be just like other men?
Hortman was referencing a former male Speaker of the House. Here she is accepting the Speaker's gavel in 2019.
And that you will faithfully discharge the duties of the office to which you have just been elected, to the best of your ability, so help you God.
I do.
Congratulations.
In her acceptance speech, she talked about focusing on the conflicts ahead.
We are not here to avoid conflict. We are here precisely to have conflict. It's an important part of the democratic process. But if we can have that conflict with good humor and humility, we'll be better off, and Minnesota will be better off.
In two decades in elected office, Hortman positioned herself as a consensus builder, willing to work with both political parties. But she was also responsible for ushering in key Democratic initiatives when her party controlled the House, Senate, and governor's office in 2023. She was instrumental in passing abortion rights, universal free lunch for students, and gun restrictions. Former Republican Representative Pat Garofalo was part of the same freshman class.
Melissa Hortman has gone down as the most consequential and impactful Speaker of the House in Minnesota history over the last 160 years. That's the politics of it. The personal side is it's really important that people understand that this was a really good person.
Last year, Minnesota voters elected an evenly divided House. Part of the power-sharing agreement included Hortman conceding the speakership to Republicans. Lawmakers blew past their adjournment deadline, and leaders met for weeks to hammer out a budget deal. After a one-day special session on Monday, Governor Tim Walz took a moment to single Hortman out for her role as a leader.
Speaker Emerita Hortman is amongst the very finest. Her pragmatic ability, her deep knowledge of how the process works, and her willingness to be pragmatic and find deals where it doesn't appear like there was help get this done.
Hortman would be the only Democrat in the House to vote for a measure that removed health care for undocumented adults in the state. The decision was part of a compromise to get a final deal. In what would be her last press conference outside the Minnesota House last week, Hortman was visibly upset.
So I'm fine. What I worry about is the people who will lose their health insurance. I know that people will be hurt by that vote, and we worked very hard to try to get a budget deal that wouldn't include that provision. And we tried any other way we could to come to a budget agreement with Republicans, and they wouldn't have it.
She said she did what leaders do, stepped up and got the job done for Minnesota. Hortman was 55 years old. Her husband, Mark, was also shot and killed in their home. They are survived by two children. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israel and Iran are exchanging missile strikes again today. Iranian state media says Israeli missiles hit two energy facilities in southern Iran, and Israeli officials say some of the Iranian missiles got through its defense system. Amid rising tensions in the Middle East, the island of Cyprus is playing an unexpected diplomatic role, with its president today saying that Iran asked Cyprus to pass, quote, some messages to Israel, though he didn't clarify beyond that. And in Minnesota, the search continues for the suspect in the shooting death of a Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband and the wounding of another state lawmaker and his wife. Police say they've recovered the car of the alleged gunman, Vance Belter. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. As widespread No Kings protests played out across the country yesterday, Los Angeles' demonstrations remained largely focused on immigration raids continuing there. For more than a week, federal law enforcement, including Immigration and Customs Enforcement, have had a big presence in the city, targeting undocumented immigrants at their homes and at work. And as that happened, Lindsay Toslowski and her team have been tracking down people who've been detained and have been hearing from their families. She is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Immigrant Defenders Law Center and joins me now. Hi, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by getting your response to these indications that the Trump administration might be shifting its strategy on these raids. On Thursday, President Trump had a post telling hospitality workers and farm workers changes were coming, saying he was hearing from people in those industries that his administration's policy was, quote, taking very good longtime workers away from them. What do you make of that, first of all? And have you seen any signs of raids slowing down?
We continue to see raids happening. We saw them happening while people were protesting in downtown Los Angeles during the No Kings March. We saw raids happening at swap meets, at car washes, just all over the city. It continues to round up, you know, hundreds of our neighbors. Many of the people we're seeing in detention centers have been in Los Angeles for more than 20 years. So while certainly we would hope that the president would relook at what he is doing in ripping our communities apart in Los Angeles, I don't know how much stock we can really put in that when the rhetoric was so different when we heard Secretary Noem's press conference just days earlier.
Right. And just to clarify, then you're saying as of Sunday, you are seeing absolutely no signs of slowing down the pace from the past week or so.
Absolutely not.
Can you just give us a sense of what your work has looked like this past weekend? What is your team doing when you get wind of another raid in another location?
Well, we're working with grassroots organizations to gather information from families. So we have a hotline that families can call when their loved ones are detained by ICE. As soon as we get that information, we have teams that are up at the local detention centers, places where we know the federal government is holding people after they detain them. And normally, when someone is detained by ICE, we would see them immediately go to an ICE detention center, and we would be able to look on the detainee locator and find them. But because of the volume of people that they are taking off of the streets in Los Angeles and from work sites, we are seeing that people are being held in actual office buildings that are not meant to house people long term. We've had reports of even entire families with small children being held in office buildings where they're only given potato chips and milk for a three-year-old child. People who are spending in days in those conditions.
And people in those situations, is it harder for groups like yours to just track who is where?
Absolutely. Out of the more than 135 people as of Friday that we had identified on our list, we were still searching for locations for more than half of them. I'll be going up to the detention center later today. We have a list of people who have been taken out of our communities all week, whose families are desperate for information on them. When we go up there, we're oftentimes only able to meet with three or four people in an entire day, spending, you know, 8 to 12 hours at the detention center. center because they are so overcrowded.
Is there any comparison point for this moment? I mean, there was a focus on detention during the first administration. As is often pointed out, President Biden and Obama also oversaw large numbers of deportations. Have you seen any comparable period to what you are experiencing right now?
No. In my 15 years of practice, I've never seen anything quite like the volume of people being taken from a particular city like Los Angeles, and, you know, and also the number of people who are just in ICE detention at this moment nationally. But it does remind me a bit of family separation and the chaos that we saw after zero tolerance when children were being ripped from their parents at the border. We are seeing that same sort of chaos with human beings' lives that we saw during family separation happening again now.
That was Lindsay Toslowski, an attorney and president of Immigrant Defenders Law Center, an organization that provides legal representation for immigrants in Southern California. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The protests in Los Angeles over ICE immigration raids is the latest in a series of recent events that have raised huge questions about presidential power. In this case, whether President Trump can use military force to control protests. One former federal judge has a stark warning that Trump's actions don't just present legal disputes, they could even signal the end of rule of law in America. J. Michael Luttig served as a federal judge for nearly 15 years. He recently wrote a piece in The Atlantic about all of this. I asked what Judge Luttig thought about a question currently before a federal appeals court. Can President Trump use the National Guard to control protests in an emergency?
At first blush, many lawyers and constitutional thinkers believe that there's no such crisis or emergency that would justify the president's calling up of the National Guard.
I mean, it just feels like in so many of these cases, President Trump is finding ways to maximize presidential power in ways that other administrations, for a wide variety of reasons, never did. I mean, like, it is very hard to stop a president from nationalizing the National Guard, even if the reason is dubious, seems to be a takeaway from this and so many other similar takeaways.
Well, that's an excellent point. And virtually all of his signature initiatives of his presidency thus far has relied upon emergency powers that he either has inherent as president or powers that have been conferred upon him, emergency powers, by the Congress of the United States. Now, in every single one of those instances, Scott, I believe that there has not been the requisite crisis, emergency, invasion, rebellion, those are the operative words of the respective statutes, to justify this president's invocation of those emergency powers.
I want to follow up on that in a moment, but first I think it's important to characterize your point of view in all of this and just give listeners who aren't familiar a little bit of context. You were appointed to the federal bench by a Republican president, President George H.W. Bush. Over the years, you were considered a conservative jurist, but you have also raised serious warnings about President Trump. How would you characterize your point of view, your concerns right now?
Well, I'm gravely worried about the president's attempted use of powers, which he does not have, even arguably have.
Judge Luttig, do you feel like worries that the president will straight up ignore an order have influenced Supreme Court rulings so far with President Trump?
Well, he already has. And that's the Garcia case. And then he's thumbed his nose at virtually every lower court decision.
Does that mean he effectively has this power then? You're talking about things that he doesn't have the power to do. He does them anyway. Courts rule in. He ignores the orders. So does he effectively have these powers that on paper he didn't have?
This president of the United States is defying the Constitution and the laws of the United States every single day. And he has thrown every one of these issues, of course, into the federal courts, overwhelming the federal courts to the point that he effectively has assumed those powers. because the courts are unable to reject his claims in time so that he does get away with it. That's a remarkably sad commentary on this president and on America at this moment.
Judge Lee, I don't want to put a positive spin on what's been like a very blunt conversation with your blunt concerns, but I'm wondering, is there one specific thing that you think could happen to improve the situation from your point of view? Is whether it's the Supreme Court taking a stronger stance or anything else? Like, what to you would ease your concerns just a little bit at this point in time, if anything?
The only thing, Scott, that can end this war on the federal courts and the rule of law in America is for the President of the United States to stand down. He is the one who has instigated this war, but it's crystal clear that at this moment, he does not want to end that war, and he has no intention of ending that war.
That is former federal judge J. Michael Luttig. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Scott.
In what is being called the largest land return in California history, more than 17,000 acres around the Klamath River have been returned to the Yurok tribe. For more than 100 years, the tribe was denied access to ancestral lands, and timber companies managed the lands instead. The land has now been renamed Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary and Yurok Tribal Community Forest, and now the tribe plans to restore the landscape through traditional indigenous stewardship. Barry McCovey is Yurok Fisheries Department Director, and he's here to tell us about the changes. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I mean, this has been a long battle. What does it mean to you to have this land back?
It's incredible. You know, Blue Creek and the forest surrounding the creek, the whole area is really important to us spiritually, culturally. And then also it's a really important stream ecologically to the lower Klamath River ecosystem. So it's a big win for the tribe.
For people who haven't seen it themselves, can you tell us a little bit about what it looks like, what it feels like to be there?
Yeah, so Blue Creek flows out of the high mountains and then down into the Klamath River near the coast of Northern California. The headwaters are very pristine, and so water quality in the creek is still really good. Of course, a lot of the watershed has been industrial timber lands, as you explained in the intro there. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of damage that has been done to the ecosystem, but the creek has been resilient and it has maintained a high level of really good water quality. It's just a really magnificent stream.
So like you said, there's been logging. By and large, Blue Creek remains in good shape, but there's work to do. Tell me about how the tribe is going to approach land management here, because it's going to be pretty different, huh?
Sure. So our idea is to have a more holistic view of land management and try and return some of the balance back to this watershed that existed there before it became industrial timberlands. So we have ideas about work we want to do down in the stream, restoration work that we want to do to kind of enhance fisheries habitat, but we also want to do a lot of work on the upslope and in the forest. So a big part of that is introducing or reintroducing good fire back onto this landscape. Fire is a tool indigenous people throughout the world have used to holistically manage forests.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned fisheries. I want to specifically mention that California salmon have been having a real hard time. I mean, it's been a huge ongoing problem in a lot of different watersheds. I understand the salmon stock is low. Can you walk us through some of the specifics about how you try to address that, how you try to turn that around now that you're taking charge of this land?
Yeah, specifically to Blue Creek, the idea there is that over time, with the timber harvest kind of aspect of things, the wood flow of the area has been depleted. So streams in forests, you know, they convey wood down the stream. So logs fall in, dead trees fall in.
We're just talking about natural wood falling here, nothing to do with the logging from before.
Naturally, yeah. Since time immemorial, since the beginning of time, these streams have been recruiting this naturally fallen wood. And then that wood kind of makes its way through the system. But as it is, it's creating log jams and it's slowing the creek down and it's creating this complex habitat within these streams. And when logging comes in and timber harvest practices, that whole system is disrupted. And so now we don't have the amount of wood in these streams that we used to. So a big push that we've been really interested in and actually have been doing in a lot of different places is adding wood back into these streams. They create habitat for adult fish, adult salmon as they're migrating upstream, juveniles as they're migrating downstream.
You need the more still water, right, for either the eggs or just for the younger fish?
Yeah, for the younger fish, they create cover and they create areas where they can rest and feed. So there's a lot of benefits to that wood loading type projects that we plan to do up there.
That's Barry McCovey, the Yurok Fisheries Department Director. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. When it comes to climate change, it's often cities at the leading edge of preparing for the future. So we're going to take a look now at Copenhagen, Denmark, a city where a single storm 14 years ago prompted it to make big changes. NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us now to tell the rest of the story. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Scott.
So let's start with that storm. 5 inches of rain sounds like a lot, but when you compare that to hurricanes, you know, here in the U.S., it does kind of pale in comparison. How did that amount of rain cause so much problems?
Yeah, there are a couple reasons for that. First off, for those who've been to Copenhagen, you know that A, it is flat, and B, it is built along the Baltic Sea. It's an ancient port. So when it rains there, water doesn't really have anywhere to go because it's at sea level. Secondly, the rainstorm that hit the city on July 2nd, 2011 was not your normal storm.
Yeah, the scientists you talked to called it a cloudburst. What exactly does that mean?
So in a normal thunderstorm, you've got strong winds moving up, and this circulation of air inside the clouds leads to sort of a towering peak at the top. And in a cloudburst, you have similar mechanics, but one key difference, meteorologists told me, is the temperature. It's warmer in the clouds that make up a cloudburst. And that, says Danish Meteorological Institute's Mark Payne, is a result of a warming climate.
As the Earth's climate warms, the air obviously becomes warmer. And warm air can hold more water. And at the same time, there's more water evaporates from the oceans and comes up into the atmosphere.
And Scott Payne says for every degree Celsius of warming, the atmosphere holds 7% more water. And in a cloudburst event, you've got a big storm cloud heavy with water. And at some point, it just dumps that water over a tight space in a short period of time. So those 5 inches of rain that fell on Copenhagen in that 2011 storm fell within a few hours, and it flooded the city, causing sewer lines to rupture, filling the streets with raw sewage. It was a total mess.
That does not sound good. No. So going forward, Copenhagen cleans itself up, and it goes straight to work to make sure it would be better prepared. Tell us what they did.
Yeah, so a year later, Copenhagen approved a $1.3 billion public works project to complete 300 flood mitigation projects throughout the city over the next 2 decades.
What are some of those projects?
So the first project is a series of 7 tunnels that were dug under the city. I went down inside one of them as a crew was putting the finishing touches on it. This particular tunnel is nearly a mile long and 10 feet in diameter. It's designed to hold 4 Olympic swimming pools worth of water. And in the event of a big storm, rainwater would be funneled into it, and then it would be pumped out of the tunnel into the sea.
I'm picturing this. It's just kind of like a large storm drain with a pump.
That's right. And in addition to these tunnels, Copenhagen has also transformed 20 parks and green spaces in the city so that each of them can turn into big reservoirs in the event of a flood. The city did this by digging into these parks, creating soccer fields and play spaces that are sunken into the parks. In one of these parks I visited, they also built a 3-foot-high concrete wall around it. And the gates that allow people into the park automatically rise out of the ground, sealing the wall shut so that the park becomes like this massive lake when it floods. So these types of parks are called sponge parks, are now found throughout Copenhagen. And the largest project the city is building is a man-made island just off the coast to protect the city from an increasing number of storm surges that can also cause flooding.
That is NPR's Rob Schmitz with a view of what one city is doing as it prepares for a change in climate. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A student from Myanmar had plans to study in the U.S., but then President Trump put restrictions on travelers from nearly 24 countries, including his. What happens now?
They told me that since I have an existing visa, I am likely to be allowed to enter. So the keyword being likely.
Plus, we'll catch you up on the nationwide protests over the weekend on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump heads to Canada tonight to attend the G7 summit in Alberta this week. The trade wars and conflict between Israel and Iran are expected to lead the talks with world economic leaders. A top-level UN conference on a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians has been postponed amid surging tensions in the Middle East. It was to have been held during the UN's General Assembly in New York. And at the weekend box office, How to Train Your Dragon debuted in the top spot with an estimated $83 million in ticket sales. The live-action adaptation of the beloved animated franchise follows the unlikely friendship between a young Viking named Hiccup and a dragon called Toothless. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It's time for our regular movie conversation. And as we mark Pride Month, my co-host Elsa Chang talked to several of our NPR colleagues about the ways queerness is portrayed both subtly and openly in a wide range of films. Elsa picks it up from here.
Across movie history, there are touchstones of queer cinema that a majority of moviegoers might recognize, like Philadelphia, one of the first mainstream Hollywood films to address the AIDS crisis.
The fact of the matter is, when they fired Andrew Beckett because he had AIDS, they broke the law.
Or Boys Don't Cry, based on the true story of Brandon Tina.
I don't know what went wrong.
You are not a boy. That is what went wrong. You are not a boy.
Tell them that. They say I'm the best boyfriend they ever had.
Or what about Brokeback Mountain, which turns 20 years old this year?
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Why don't you?
These are only some of the most well-known examples of queerness in movies. At other times, queerness may just be one facet of a film that has much more on its mind. This Pride Month, we wanted to talk about all of this, so we brought in NPR film critic Bob Mondello and All Things Considered producers Mallory Yu and Erica Ryan. Hello to all three of you.
Hey, Elsa. Good to be here.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey, Elsa. So, you know, in these films that I specifically mentioned, queerness, you know, it's front and center, or at least a very important part of the story in those films. But I was curious to hear from you guys about movies where queerness or queer characters aren't necessarily center stage. Like, no one's saying the word gay or trans in the movie, but you can still read queerness out of it. Because I feel like there's a rich history there, right, Bob?
Well, yeah. I guess we could go all the way back to the very first film that won a Best Picture Oscar, Wings, in 1927. No one said the word gay or trans because no one said any words in it. It was a silent film. Uh-huh. But there were all these touchstones for gay audiences. A lesbian couple featured prominently, like front and center in a nightclub scene. Mm. And the two main characters, who were fighter pilots, share a moment where one of them is dying that includes a lot of love-struck looks and a kiss on the lips. And this was all pre-Hays Code, the rules that Hollywood adopted later in the 1930s that forbade any hint of homosexuality. But things got a little less overt after that. But Marlene Dietrich in a tuxedo and top hat in 1930s Morocco was more than just coded. Vito Russo wrote a book in 1981 called The Celluloid Closet that elaborated on dozens of films up to that point with characters who were clearly queer, plot lines that were clearly meant to be read as queer. And at about the time the book came out, HIV/AIDS altered the equation forever. So suddenly there was a reason to be talking very openly about queer characters. They were central to a societal horror story that was playing out in the real world. And in films, they faced the horror and did something about it, which the rest of society wasn't doing. Philadelphia is an excellent example, but there were dozens of others, theater and television, too.
Absolutely. Well, Mallory, I'm curious, what are a couple of your favorite, how do I put this, like, gayest non-gay movies?
Okay, so my favorites are a bit more recent than Bob's. I would not be myself if I didn't talk about Disney's Mulan, because come on, she's singing about her reflection, not showing who she really is, while I might add she is femmed up. Then she dresses and passes as a man for most of the movie, and her love story with her commanding officer begins while she's passing as a man. So even though they end up in a seemingly heterosexual relationship, I think it's still a queer one.
Yeah.
Another one of my favorites is from 2002, Bend It Like Beckham.
Girls aren't supposed to play soccer.
Mom's never wanted me to play. You just can't take no for an answer.
There's a love triangle with a male coach, but the movie is so gay. One of them, there's not just a canonically gay character who likes David Beckham. There is a female character who's mistaken as a boy, and her mom becomes convinced that she's gay, you know, because she wears sports bras and has short hair and plays soccer and isn't girly, right?
Right. No boy's gonna want to go out with a girl who's got bigger muscles than him.
Why don't you just leave her alone?
I'm not gonna give it up.
All I'm saying is there is a reason why Sporty Spice is the only one of them without a fella.
Very 2002, but sure, the movie ends with one of them getting with this male soccer coach, but at the very end, the two women go off to college together, and it is absolutely implied that there is something happening there.
Totally. Some tension, at the very least. Erica, what about you?
One that comes to mind is Fried Green Tomatoes.
Oh, Andy, what's your mother going to say when she sees us both drunk?
You got to stop worrying about what people think.
To me, Iggy and Ruth have a very obviously lesbian relationship in the movie, I would say. Sure. It's kind of left up to debate in the actual movie. The novel, apparently, I will disclaimer, I haven't read it, explicitly calls it a lesbian relationship. The film doesn't do that. One of my actual, like, all-time favorite movies, Midnight Cowboy from 1969.
Cowboy, huh?
Well, sir, I ain't a for real cowboy. But I am one hell of a stud.
The gayness on this is also debated, but it focuses on a cowboy that comes to the city and is working as a sex worker, and he becomes friends with a man named Rizzo. They develop a really close relationship, which to me, it could have sort of be qualified as a buddy movie, but I think it's a little bit more deep than that.
I remember watching it and thinking, no, this is a love story.
Yeah.
You're right. It wasn't labeled that at the time, but yeah.
I don't think I can walk anymore. I mean, I've been falling down a lot. I'm scared.
What are you scared of?
You know what they do to you when they know you can't. When they find out that you can't walk.
I'm not going to tell you this is an uplifting film, because it broke my heart into a million pieces, but it's still one of my favorites.
Well, what about movies where, like, the characters might be queer, but that is not the driving part of the story?
Well, would you count Dog Day Afternoon?
Robbing a bank's a federal offense. They got me on kidnapping, armed robbery. They're going to bury me, man.
Or maybe the Daniel Craig detective in the Glass Onion movies.
Oh,
or,
sure.
Right? I mean, it's not significant to the plot particularly, but it's there.
Well, get that, would you?
You're not in the bath again, are you?
No,
I remember there was a movie, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, in 2005, a police procedural, in which Val Kilmer played a gay cop and was very upsetting to Robert Downey Jr.'s, I forgot what he was a thief or something like that, but but it was very upsetting to him that he was having to deal with this gay guy.
Jesus, look up idiots in the dictionary, you know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
It wasn't a romance or anything. It was just there in the movie, right? And it was interesting to see
like
Kilmer playing the, yeah.
Well, for me, the first thing that comes to mind, which this is, you know, a big part of the plot, but Bound, 1996, by the Wachowski sisters, two women fall in love or start a relationship.
My name's Violet. We sort of met on the elevator.
Sure, I'm Corky.
Corky.
Jennifer Tilly is dating a mobster, and next door, the other character is doing handyman work on the apartment. They fall in love. Turns out her boyfriend, the violent mobster, has tons and tons of money. They come up with this plot to steal it. It is so sexy. It's like an erotic lesbian film.
What did she do to you?
Everything you couldn't.
But it also just turns into like a violent mob thriller. And also, because it's the Wachowski sisters, there's like so much leather and slow motion. Like, I love it. Just very Matrix.
Like, aesthetically, what's not to like?
Yeah, exactly.
For me, I really love The Watermelon Woman from 1996, written and directed by a black lesbian filmmaker named Cheryl Dunier. She also stars in a movie.
Hi, I'm Cheryl, and I'm a filmmaker. I'm not really a filmmaker, but I have a videotaping business with my friend Tamara, and I work at a video store, so I'm working on being a filmmaker.
And what I really liked about this movie is that, yes, Cheryl is a lesbian, and that suffuses all of the ways that she interacts with her friends and lovers and even the actresses that she's researching. But the movie is also a really lovely and also kind of sad reflection on the ways in which black women and all the nuances of their identities and sexualities and love lives have been sidelined throughout Hollywood's history.
You know, I'm kind of listening to you talk about movies where gay characters were not the driving part of the story. And it seems like there's a difference between rich characters in a movie that also happen to be queer and then characters that are gay in a way that perpetuates stereotypes about being gay, like maybe in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, right? Like, there's a difference with how Hollywood has portrayed gayness, queerness, in these movies when the gay story is not the driving part of the story.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's all such an improvement over the period of the 50s and 60s, where the closet was the central metaphor, right? The whole thing about the way that gay characters were treated for the longest time in Hollywood was that the presumption was this was a terrible fault of character and of morality, and that therefore should be pushed off to the side. And if you were going to be sympathetic, I mean, do you remember there was a long time when you couldn't have a story about a gay character that was affirmative where the gay character didn't die
yes,
at the end,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it was just for the longest time, it was like that.
Or it couldn't end happily.
Right.
I'd also say that there are more and more queer filmmakers and writers get opportunities to make the movies that they are writing
sure.
from their own perspectives. We're kind of getting more and more nuanced stories where the stories don't have to be about being gay, but it can just be a fact of the characters. Or
Yeah. We're intersections of all kinds of identities.
My wife and I are constantly on a search for movies that are gay and not depressing. Mm-hmm. And we've found quite a few, but there are so many that are just like, rip my heart out and stomp on it. Sad.
Okay, so what are just like, say, a couple queer movies that are in all of your personal canons, so to speak?
Can I start?
Yeah.
This is silly, but when I was not a teenager, I was in my 20s, a movie came out called La Cage aux Folles. And I remember seeing it with a mixed audience, meaning there were some gay people in there, but it was mostly a straight audience. And I was not out of the closet at this point. And I was so grateful. It was a French film and there were subtitles. And had there not been subtitles, we would have missed whole scenes because people were laughing so hard. It was so reassuring to me to see a show that was clearly a crossover thing where the people around me were laughing for the same reason I was. It was a hilarious farce. It was just magic. That was crossover. That was what I had been hoping all my life was going to happen. And there it was. And it was just magic.
Yeah. Mallory?
One of my favorites, this isn't a fictional movie, it's a documentary, but it's Paris is Burning, directed by Jenny Livingston.
I'm Willie Ninja, the mother of the House of Ninja.
Give him what he wants!
I'm the mother of the House of Ninja because they say I'm the best vulgar out.
I revisit this documentary about New York City ball culture in all of its bombast and joy, and I just find so much comfort, especially recently, in the fierce and joyful self-expression that its subjects manage in the face of violence and marginalization, homophobia, classism, racism. I mean, it's lovely and grim and joyful, and I love it.
And so, Erica, in the spirit of trying to find happier ones, one that I watched recently that I absolutely love is Saving Face from 2004.
How come we never met before now?
We did meet.
I was 8, you were 9. The Wong boys were taunting me.
You beat the heck out of them.
It's about like two Chinese-American women that fall in love, and it talks about sort of like homophobia and being afraid to come out, but then her mother gets pregnant, and so they both have this secret that they're hiding, and it's just like, it's a really like lovely,
a
really lovely sort of rom-com. And then honestly, also recent, one of the ones that I just like absolutely love and is hilarious and super gay is Bottoms, that came out in 2023.
Oh yeah.
Hey Brittany.
PJ, I am loving all the holes in your pants.
Thanks.
You look like a little Dutch boy.
Thank you.
So that movie was so funny, and like that's the kind of stuff that I like to see, is just like queer filmmakers just like doing whatever they want and like having fun with it and just making stuff for us to enjoy.
That was NPR's Erica Ryan, Mallory Yu, and Bob Mondello. Thank you to all three of you. This was great.
Thank you, Elsa.
Thanks, Elsa.
Eternatus is one of the most powerful Pokemon there is. It's in the gigantic/legendary classification. I know this because my son Josh told me, and I am telling you this because sometimes he asks me to sneak words into the show as a kind of a secret message. That is often hard to do, but for Father's Day, I prioritized it, and Eternatus was one of the words. Others on this week's list included TV and cactus. Happy Father's Day to everyone out there who can relate. And a special Father's Day shout out to some of the other dads working on our show staff today, producer Gabriel Sanchez, as well as our all things considered technical directors, Neil Tebalt and Ted Mebane. And finally, to my dad, John, who spent a lot of time in front of a microphone himself. That is all things considered for this Sunday. Thank you for listening to us in a weekend filled with news. We will talk to you again soon. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at subaru.com/care. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.